Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Framed ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
We are investigating the Temple murders.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I don't think that's a surprise to you, is it?
No.
No.
My goal in this investigation is to find out the individuals who pulled the triggers on these 9 victims.
So what do you want me to say? I want you to start telling me what happened on August 9th, what your involvement is, who all was there at the temple.
We know what happened, okay? I'm going to tell you exactly what happened, right?
We came back about, I don't know, half an hour later.
Yeah,
half an hour later.
I
did
not do this, man! I didn't do this!
And at that time, I just panicked and I just pulled up and I just started shooting. Get out of there, shoot. You know, like something came over me. Should I mention now, like, who was involved? What?
This is Framed. I am your host, Aaron. On the morning of Saturday, August 10th, 1991, 9 victims were found lying face down in a circle in Wad Kunaram, a Buddhist temple located in the rural town of Waddell, Arizona. Each victim sustained at least one gunshot wound to the back of the head. 21 shots were fired in total. The gunmen didn't miss once. By the time the bodies were discovered, they were cold to the touch. The shooters had long since fled the scene, leaving, as it seemed, without a trace. Amongst the victims were 6 monks, 1 elderly nun, the nun's 17-year-old grandson, and the head monk's 16-year-old cousin who was visiting from Thailand. As news of the slaying spread, members of the Wad Kunaram community began gathering outside the temple. Reporters from the Arizona Republic were at the scene that day covering the story. They wrote that, despite 100-degree heat, over 90 members of the temple were there, anxious to know the answer to one question. Why? Why did they have to kill them? Initial reports noted that the police were investigating a robbery and gang activities as potential motives. They speculated that robbers might have found out that temple members brought cash offerings when they arrived for prayers. Others in the Wad Kunaram community believed that racism may have been the motive, since most of the families who attended services were either Thai, Cambodian, or Laotian immigrants. Smith Tongkum was a board member at the temple, and he was amongst those gathered outside the crime scene. He told reporters, "I think it was probably some rednecks. There was no robbery. Monks really don't have anything to steal, and Asian gang members probably wouldn't do this. Most of them are Buddhists too." Given the magnitude of the crime and the possibility that the murders could be considered a hate crime, local politicians and law enforcement officials knew a strong response was warranted. A major crimes task force was formed that was comprised of 66 law enforcement officers from federal, state, and local levels. Investigators spent 6 days processing the crime scene, but when it was all said and done, they had no DNA evidence, no fingerprints identifying the perpetrators, and no direct witnesses. Detectives had to roll up their sleeves and rely on good old-fashioned police work. Detective Riley, a key member of the task force, used an analogy to describe their approach to solving this crime. He told a suspect,
"What we do to get answers and explain things is we talk to a lot of people and ask specific questions and we get specific answers. Okay, sometimes they're vague and general answers, but they help to paint a picture. When we do that, we don't just talk to one person. We talk to 5, 10, 20, 100 people if we have to. And it's kind of like a jigsaw puzzle that you put together, that whenever you get a piece of information, you put it in that puzzle, then it starts to paint a big picture."
This approach produced results quickly. In a little under 3 months' time, the task force had 8 suspects in custody. Even though they had enough evidence to make those arrests, the big picture was still a bit fuzzy. The problem with this jigsaw puzzle was that the pieces of information provided by their suspects didn't quite fit together. Each suspect had a different story to tell. The final decision on which suspects to pursue charges against fell to the Maricopa County State's Attorney's Office. Of the 8 suspects that were detained initially, 6 were released from custody. One suspect reached an agreement with the state and pleaded guilty, and the other pleaded not guilty and went to trial. The trial began on May 19, 1993. It started the same way every other trial does. The state gets to go first since they bear the burden of proof. In their opening statements, the prosecution tells the jury what happened, who did it, and why they did it. They say, trust us, we're going to prove it to you. In contrast to the prosecution's meticulously laid out narrative, the defense typically doesn't have a narrative of their own to present. If an alternative theory for the crime isn't obvious, the defense attorney's best play is to try to raise doubt about the prosecution's case. So what happens when one side confidently says, we know what happened, and the other side says, we don't know what happened? The way these competing narratives are framed has the potential to bias a jury. It may even tip the scales of justice in favor of the state. Our approach to this case is going to be a little different. Rather than telling you up front which suspects the state charged, we're going to start with a blank slate and see where the facts lead us. Whether we arrive at the same conclusions the jurors did remains to be seen, but what we can promise you is this. There's more to this story than anyone but a handful of people on this earth know. A word of caution to those looking to research this case themselves. Before the investigation concluded, 1,300 leads were pursued, which generated over 100,000 pages of reports. This was the largest case file in the state's history. The frame team has read every news article, every published book, we've watched every documentary, and we've scoured the internet for every archived blog post. Having gone through it all, we can tell you that there's a lot of misinformation floating around out there about this case. We know this because we have also obtained and reviewed the entire case file. We have the original police reports, the lab reports, crime scene photos, and transcripts detailing not only what was said in the courtroom, but the interrogation rooms as well. Amongst the hundreds of thousands of pages of raw information we have gathered, there may be an answer to a question first posed 28 years ago. What exactly happened in the Wat Kunaram Temple on a warm summer night in 1991? The temple life was routine, simple, with each day similar to the last. Some of the monks slept in until about 8 when morning prayers began. Others started their day a little earlier, between 5 and 6 a.m. Pirate Gontong was amongst the early risers. He was the head monk, or abbot, of the temple. One of Pirate's passions in life was gardening. The best time to work the garden was in the morning, before the desert heat was at its worst. The temple sat on a 5-acre lot, which was relatively modest in size for this rural farming community. As you can imagine, water was a scarce but vital resource for the people of Wat El. An irrigation system was installed in 1974, which consisted of 6 miles of concrete ditches and a well. A weekly sign-up sheet was maintained by the well, where local residents could pencil in requests for water disbursements. The temple's garden wasn't big enough to utilize even the minimum amount of water you could order, but thankfully for Pyruk's gardening hobby, they had a neighbor who was in a similar situation. Betty Kraft lived a half mile down the road. She had an arrangement with Pyruk, where they would sign up for water together. This took some coordination on their part to make sure that when the water came in, it was split fairly between their two properties. The final disbursement schedule was posted at the well every Friday. On the evening of August 9, 1991, a little before 9:30 p.m., Betty met with Pyruk at the sign-up sheet. They saw they were scheduled to receive water the following morning. There was a brief chat between the two that ended with Betty reminding Pyruk to make sure his head gate was closed. The head gate was a door in the ditch that, when closed, would prevent water from continuing to flow down the ditch to other properties. The next morning, Betty noticed their water order came in a little early, around 6:30 a.m. She tried to call the temple at 7, but the phone was busy. Betty called every 10 to 15 minutes, and still, she got a busy signal. Finally, she decided to drive over to the temple. She arrived sometime between 8:30 and 9 a.m. As she approached the temple, she noticed that Pyruk forgot to close their headgate. Betty banged on a side door, but there was no answer. She opened the door and peeked inside. When she did, she noticed something she had never seen before. The countertop in the temple's kitchen was free of clutter and was wiped clean. Betty hollered, Anyone in there? She got no response. She walked around the back of the property where there was a set of double doors near a patio. The irrigation water was flooding the back patio. Betty thought to herself that the monks must have left their hose on, anticipating the morning's water. She knocked on the back doors one last time, then returned home to complete her irrigation. Now for this next part, we're going to be taking you inside the temple. As the saying goes, a picture is worth a thousand words. So if you would like to see the temple floor plan, head over to framedpod.com. And just to forewarn you, included in the file with the floor plan are several drawings depicting where the victims' bodies were found and their arrangement. The pictures are not gruesome in any way, but they are very detailed and could be upsetting to see if you weren't expecting it. So again, that's framedpod.com to see the temple layout. Chawi Borders and Premjit Hash arrived at Wad Kunaram at 10:45 a.m. that morning. They were both members of the temple, and it was their turn to cook lunch for the monks. Back in Thailand, meals were handled differently. Tradition dictated that monks would go door to door, begging for food. They ate whatever they were given and were thankful for the food they received. In their culture, begging for food wasn't frowned upon, it was admired. It showed their commitment to their religion, their minimalist lifestyle, and to their pursuit of truth. In America, begging for food had a negative stigma, and on top of that, it just wasn't practical. Their neighbors' houses were too far apart, and the Arizona sun was intense. While the monks had to adapt to the American setting, they did adhere to most other Buddhist practices. One tradition that stuck with them from Thailand was that the monks would eat one meal before midday, and that was it. The rest of the day was reserved for meditation. When Borders and Hash arrived at the temple that morning, the irrigation water had spilled over onto the parking lot, forcing Borders to park the car on the east side of the building. Hash got out of the car first and tried to open the main doors leading into the temple worship area. The main doors were locked, so Hash walked around to the side door, which was the same door Betty Craft peeked through a few hours earlier. Before entering the temple, Hash made sure to take off her shoes. Shoes weren't allowed inside. This was a rule that was strictly followed by all those who visited Wad Kunaram. Hash walked down a back hallway that led to the kitchen. She glanced over into the dining/living room and saw all the monks lying on the floor. She thought they were sleeping and didn't think much of it. Hash went into the kitchen, dropped off some food, and began boiling water for the rice. She then walked through the worship area to unlock the main doors for Borders. Hash whispered to Borders, "Don't make any noise. All the monks are laying on the floor sleeping." Hash went back to the kitchen while Borders made her way to the dining room. She noticed the nun was lying on the floor with the monks, which baffled her. This was forbidden in their religion, for a nun to sleep so closely to a monk. She said, "Wake up, monks, wake up." At that moment, Borders thought she heard a phone ring. Right next to her in the dining room, there was a payphone mounted on the wall, which she picked up. Not only was there no one on the other line, there was no dial tone at all. There was another phone on the dining room table, but before Borders could make her way to that phone, she saw that the line running to it had been cut. Her gaze turned back to the monks, and that's when she saw it. There was a pool of blood on the carpet near where their heads came together. She cried out, "Who killed them? Who killed my monks?" Borders hurried into the kitchen, grabbed Hash's hand, and said, "We have to go." They ran out of the temple barefoot, drove to the nearest neighbor, and called 911. Over the next several days, investigators combed through the temple gathering evidence. They took care to document the smallest detail. What we're going to do now is walk you through the crime scene, room by room, and fill you on the detective's findings as we go. Wad Kunaram was comprised of the monks' living quarters and the temple's worship area. The layout for the living quarters took the shape of a long rectangle that ran from north to south. The temple's worship area jutted off the living quarters and ran east to west. Together, the two gave the building the shape of a capital L. We'll start our tour in the worship area. Around the perimeter of this large room were a few chairs and couches, but the center was wide open. On the west side of the room was the shrine. A golden statue of Buddha served as the shrine's centerpiece. It sat atop a series of stacked decorative coffee tables. Around the Buddha were various trinkets, some candles, and vases filled with colorful flowers. This was the first room detectives entered, and what stood out to them the most was how orderly everything was. It didn't appear as though anything had been taken. There wasn't furniture turned over, Nothing was rummaged through. One detail about this room that made its way to the media was that just to the right of the shrine, in plain sight, was a money tree. A money tree was one way the temple raised funds for a particular purpose. Members would tape dollar bills to this miniature tree when making their donations to the cause. Another detail that was less publicized, but perhaps even more significant, was that around the shrine were four wooden boxes filled with cash donations. Each box had a small opening for members to insert their offerings. A simple padlock on each box was all that stood between the intruders and fistfuls of cash. The boxes weren't tampered with at all. People wondered, if this was a burglary, why didn't they take cash from the donation boxes and money tree? It seemed the intruders weren't very familiar with the temple. On the northwest corner of the worship area was a door that led to the monks' living quarters. Just through that doorway on the left was a room no bigger than most closets. Because the nun wasn't allowed to sleep near the monks, this area was converted to a sleeping alcove. There was a mattress and a nightstand, but little space for much else. In the northwest corner of the building was the kitchen, which was pretty standard. There was an island in the center of the square room. The countertops were clean, no drawers were open. Nothing was out of place. Just south of the kitchen was the dining room. On the wall that separated the kitchen from the dining room was the payphone. Right next to the payphone was a steel safe that stood 5 feet tall. When they dusted the safe for prints, they found something interesting. Someone wearing latex gloves had been touching the safe. Another clue. Right next to the safe on the dining room table was a pile of keys. All the keys in the temple had been gathered in this one spot. In order to open the safe, you needed a key and the combination. Apparently, the intruders were after whatever was in the safe, but they never got it open. The monks had the key, but none of them knew the combination. There was a small storage room to the south of the dining room. It was clear the intruders had been in this room. It was a mess. Rice was spilled all over the carpeting. Drawers from a china cabinet were removed and thrown about. A pair of scissors and some cleaning supplies were scattered on the floor. There were also two overturned stools in the entryway to the storage room. Now for the living room. This is the area where the bodies of all 9 victims were found. Although this space was used as a living room, by design it was just a wide hallway that connected the worship area to the living quarters. Couches lined the walls of this walkway. In between the couches, tightly packed together, were the victims' bodies. We told you earlier that the bodies were arranged in a circle. This is how the arrangement has often been described in newspaper articles and even in the courtroom, but there's no substitute for seeing the real thing. We recommend checking out the diagrams posted to framedpod.com to help you make sense of the crime scene. The most important pieces to this puzzle were found amongst the victims. 21 shell casings were lying on top of the bodies, under the victims in some instances, and atop the couch cushions. 17 of the bullets were fired from the same gun. Due to some unique markings left on the casings by the gun's firing pin, experts at the FBI were able to determine the make and model of the weapon. The bullets were fired from a .22 caliber semi-automatic rifle manufactured by the Marlin Company. For those of you not all that familiar with guns, .22 caliber weapons are just about the weakest firearms on the market. This type of weapon is often used for target shooting, or on very small game like rats and birds. The other 4 shell casings were fired from a 20-gauge shotgun. The shotgun casings were found to the south of the bodies. The pellets fired from the shotgun were tiny, number 8 birdshot to be exact. Rounds this small were typically used for hunting quail or pheasants. Upon seeing the caliber of weapons that were used in the murders, one of the detectives remarked that this was done by a couple farm kids, probably got their guns from their dad's closet. We need to take a few moments for our amazing sponsors, Best Fiends. We've all been there. We're caught up on the news stories of the day, and we're waiting in a lobby at our doctor's office. How can we pass the time? Best Fiends, a match 3 casual mobile puzzle game, provides great entertainment anytime, anywhere. Join the Best Fiends on their epic journey through the majestic world of Minutia as they battle the slugs of Mount Boom. Upgrade and evolve your growing group of fiends to help you clear levels and get achievements. You can select which ones to use or have the game auto-select them for you. I especially enjoy the challenges as they reward you with resources to upgrade your fiends, and I even have a few favorite fiends that I like to use on the more difficult levels, such as Pop and Vincent Van Moth. And trust me, this game is constantly evolving too. Each month, more levels, events, and challenges are added to keep the fun going. I'm on level 139. Why not download Best Fiends today? The colorful characters and exciting level designs will keep you engaged as you find more ways to solve the level puzzles. Download Best Fiends today on the Apple Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R. Best Fiends.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
To give you a little more information on the victims and the manner in which they died, I'm going to read this next part directly from the prosecutor's opening remarks. Foysi Ponprasert was 75 years old. She was born in Thailand on January 1, 1916. She had come to this country to live near her daughter, Fong Miller, and her family. Although Foy had been a member for years, she had only moved into the temple a few weeks before the massacre. She was dressed entirely in white, and her body was to the extreme north of the rough circle. She was killed by two 22 caliber bullets which struck the back of her head. There were shotgun pellets in her outer left forearm. The shotgun wounds did not cause her death, and they were not life-threatening. She was stretched out prone with her hands under her face. To Foy's right on the west side of the circle was Somsak Sopa. He was a Buddhist monk. He was dressed in an orange and saffron-colored robe, which was typical for monks of his religion. He was born on May 7, 1945, in Thailand. He had entered the monkhood at the age of 20. He was considered excellent in the English language, typing, and accounting. He was a teacher of Buddhism, a missionary, and former abbot of a temple in Thailand. Somsak had previously served in Sri Lanka, the Philippines, Burma, Malaysia, Taiwan, and India. He was fatally shot twice by a .22 rifle, once above and to the rear of his right ear, and once below the right ear. He was also hit by a vicious but non-fatal shotgun blast to the right bicep and elbow, which apparently continued across Somsak's face, right eye, and forehead. These shotgun wounds were serious, but did not cause his death. He was lying face down with his hands under his face. To Somsak Sopa's immediate right was Sang Gingao. Clad in saffron also, Sang was born July 5, 1956 in Thailand. He became a novice in Buddhism in 1967 at age 11. He became a monk in 1978 at age 22, and he was a teacher of Buddhist studies. He received his bachelor's degree in education in 1989. And he was killed by two .22 shots, one to the back of the head, one below the right ear. He also sustained mutilating but non-lethal shotgun wounds to the left shoulder, left forearm, and left hand. He had 8 abrasions to his left inner knee and under his chin. He was also missing the tip of his right middle finger. He was lying flat on the floor with his arms bent at 90-degree angles. To Sang Gingao's right was Suchai Anutaro, a Buddhist monk who also was wearing an orange and saffron-colored robe. Suchai was born in Thailand on April 13, 1958, and became a monk in 1979. He was invited to do missionary work at Wakunaram in 1984 and served there ever since. He was the best handyman in the temple. He could drive the tractor and cook the meals. He was killed by two .22 shots, one to the rear, center to his head, one to the right cheek. He had slight abrasions to both knees, and a small abrasion above the rear gunshot wound. He received no shotgun wounds. Suchai was found prone, flat on the ground. His hands were under his face. To Suchai's south and right was Jirasok Jirapong, a 16-year-old male visitor to the temple from Thailand. He was known universally by the nickname Boy. Jirasok, or Boy, was not a monk, but he was referred to as a temple helper. He had come to Arizona with the head monk, his cousin, 5 or 6 months previously from Thailand. His hair was collar length, while all the others had their heads closely shaved. He wore a blue polo t-shirt and white shorts. He was shot and killed by one .22 bullet to the rear center of his head. He, too, was stretched out flat, face down into the carpet, with his hands clasped in a prayerful, begging, or beseeching position at the top of his head. On Jirasak's right was Pyra Gontong. He was the abbot of the temple and had been so since 1985. Pyruk became a monk in 1975 and was a native of Thailand, having been born there on March 30, 1955. He held a diploma from the Polythenic Institute of Thornbury in Thailand, where Pyruk had spent some 4 or 5 months helping to build a temple in his hometown. The purchase of the land in Arizona and the construction of this temple were due to his many efforts. He was a very tactful leader, and everyone loved him. He was shot twice in the skull with a .22, once on the top left, once on the lower left of his head. These wounds were fatal. Pyruk was lying face down with his arms above his head, his hands clasped together in a prayerful or supplicating fashion. Crammed into this narrow space next to Pyruk was Matthew Miller, 16-year-old son of Fong and Stephen Miller, and the grandson of Foy, the 75-year-old nun who was also part of this fatal circle. Matthew was an apprentice monk or novice, one of those who had come to the Buddhist temple for a temporary sojourn to learn of their religion, to pray, to meditate, to cleanse himself spiritually and physically, and hopefully to find peace. Matthew was, in all other ways, a typical 16-year-old teenager and high school student. Matthew was shot twice in the back, right side of his head. He, like Gontong, was lying flat with his arms extended, hands together, consistent with prayer or humble beseeching. Next to Matthew was Chulum Juntapim. Chulum was born January 13, 1958 in Thailand. He had a bachelor's degree in human relations from a Buddhist university and became a monk in 1979. He was a missionary and teacher, and he came to Wat Kunaram Temple in 1990. He was immediately next to Matthew, his left side overlapping part of Matthew Miller. He was uncharacteristically shot 3 times with the .22, all to the back of the head, all within 2.5 inches of the other. These wounds were fatal. There were no other injuries to Chulum. Between Chulum Juntapim and Foy Si Pan Prasert, the nun, and completing the circle, was Bunchoy Chirot, another monk wearing a saffron robe. Bunchoy was born January 5, 1954, became a monk at the age of 20. He served as an abbot in Thailand and a missionary in India, the Philippines, the Netherlands, and Arizona. He taught Sunday school, Buddhist studies, meditation. His personal motto was work and serve. He was shot and he was killed by one .22 shot to the back right side of his head. He was also hit by shotgun pellets in the area of the right elbow and forearm and the upper left buttocks. The shot pattern is about 4 inches in diameter, making this a deep and severe wound, though not fatal. There is a third non-penetrating shotgun wound to the left side of Boon Choi's head. Some of the detectives who helped process the scene later recalled what that room smelled like. The smell of death was prominent, but there was something else lingering in the air. Stale cigarette smoke. The source of that smell? At the very center of the bodies on the floor was a glass ashtray. There were several cigarette butts in that tray. A few were identified as Marlboros. Investigators couldn't determine the brand on most of the other cigarette butts. The ashtray and its contents were checked into evidence and marked as Exhibit 142. To the south of the living room, there was a hallway that ran vertically through the living quarters. In the hallway, just beyond the doorway, there was a word carved into the wall. In block letters 2 to 3 feet tall, the culprits had etched the word Bloods right into the drywall. When the detectives told the public they were investigating gang activities as a motive, this was probably why. Going down the hallway now, there were 4 doors to the left and 4 to the right. The first room on the left was an office. In total, there were 5 bedrooms. All of the rooms were ransacked. Mattresses were turned over. Clothes were tossed around. A soda can was poured into a computer in the office. Senseless destruction. Through some good detective work, investigators were able to figure out some of the items that had been taken from the bedrooms. There were empty boxes for various electronics found in the temple, but the items were missing. A boombox. A Walkman, a power horn, a police scanner, several cameras, and a video recorder were all unaccounted for. At the end of the hallway, just past the bedrooms, were 2 small restrooms. One was to the left, and the other was to the right. There was nothing significant found in the restrooms. The same can't be said of the laundry room, which was at the far southern end of the hallway. Someone had expelled a fire extinguisher onto the tile floor, which made it easier to see what the culprits had left behind. Shoe prints. Shoes weren't allowed in the temple, so it was unlikely that these prints belonged to temple members. The markings created by the shoes were distinct. The crime lab was able to determine the prints were left by cold-weather combat boots from two different people. So that about sums up what detectives found on their first pass through the crime scene. Even though they had some good physical evidence, it wasn't much to go off of. The best lead they had was the shell casings, but 22 caliber weapons were so prevalent, they were left with a long list of potential suspects. To help narrow the list down, the task force requested help from the FBI. Two agents from Quantico, Virginia, flew in to tour the temple and review the crime scene photos. The agents were psychological profilers from the Behavioral Science Unit. Due to the limited information available, they were unable to develop a formal psychological profile of the killers, but they were able to make some educated guesses that could help guide investigators. Russ Kimball prepared a written report detailing the information provided by the FBI agents. It stated the following. The agents felt more than one person was responsible for the murders. They based this in part on paradoxical behavior indicators found at the scene. The remote location of the temple, the fact that gloves were worn and phone lines were cut, among other things, led them to surmise that planning had been an important activity for the suspects. These types of artifacts indicate a rather high level of criminal sophistication. The fact that the victims had been slain also suggested at least one of the suspects could have had a past history of violent offenses. Reasons given for this supposition were that murder is a grand leap beyond burglary or robbery. One would probably be schooled in crime before taking such a leap. Another possibility offered was also speculative. The actual killer, or dominant personality, had been arrested and possibly convicted in the past through witness and/or fingerprint identification. He chose to leave no witnesses this time. A far less level of sophistication was indicated by choice of weapons, the ransacking, and the spraying of the fire extinguisher. These behaviors could indicate a younger or more juvenile personality. The agents felt one dominant male personality was involved with one or more lesser personalities who could possibly fear him and even try to emulate him. Both agents believed the word "Bloods" carved on a wall in the temple was probably a red herring, intended to throw investigators off track. While the crime scene was being analyzed, other detectives canvassed the area. They made their way through the crowd of people gathered outside the temple and took down statements from everyone. They knocked on doors of neighboring houses and fielded calls from people who thought they had something relevant to share with police. Hundreds of reports were prepared documenting the information they received in those first few days of the investigation. While most of the people they talked to during the canvass had nothing to offer, there were others who provided important information. It's worth mentioning that there was more than one neighbor who reported hearing gunshots near the temple around 8:30 p.m. that evening. Whatever those neighbors heard, it was likely unrelated to the murders. We know Pyrock didn't meet with Betty Kraft at the well until 9:30 p.m., and the medical examiner estimated the time of death for all nine victims somewhere between 2 and 4 a.m. Several witnesses told detectives about a suspicious vehicle they spotted at the temple on the morning of Saturday, August 10th. Mr. Green was interviewed on Sunday, August 11th. He told the detectives that he attended a Baptist church located a short distance from Wat Kumaram. And just so you can get your bearings while we go through this, Wat Kumaram was located on Maryland Avenue, one block west of where Maryland intersects with Cotton Lane. The Baptist church Mr. Green attended was located on Cotton Lane, just south of Maryland. There was a Bible study at the Baptist church the week before, and they had set up a large circus-type tent. Mr. Green, along with other members of the church, were to meet at 7 a.m. that Saturday to take down the tent. He was the first one to arrive that morning, right at 6:45. He looked around in all directions to see if anyone was coming to assist with the tent. That's when he saw a very bright and shiny, immaculate-looking red and white Ford Bronco II with tinted windows. The vehicle appeared to be exiting the west driveway of the Buddhist temple, traveling at a very slow rate of speed. The Bronco continued eastbound on Maryland, accelerating to 25 to 30 miles per hour. It came to a stop at Maryland and Cotton Lane, then turned north. Mr. Green was certain the vehicle was a Ford Bronco II because his two stepsons also own Ford Bronco IIs. He added that it looked like the vehicle had just been driven off the showroom floor. He had never seen a vehicle that clean in the area due to the fact that with the dirt roads, most of them are covered with a layer of dust and dirt. The vehicle's cleanliness is what caused him to take note of it. Pam lived a block to the west of the temple. She told the police that on the morning of August 10th at around 6 a.m., she went outside to water some bushes they had planted along the property line on the north side of Maryland. Between 6:30 and 7 a.m., while she was at the corner of Maryland and K Way, she noticed a suburban-type vehicle driving east on Maryland, going extremely slow. Pam thought this vehicle came out of the temple parking lot. She didn't remember anything unusual about the vehicle other than it had dark, tinted windows. Glenn was employed at the Waddell Post Office and delivered mail to the temple regularly. On Saturday morning, he was driving northbound on Cotton Lane, en route to the post office. As he approached Maryland, he saw a red Bronco II with a white stripe. He was sure it was a Bronco II because he also drove one. Glenn noticed the passenger in the vehicle had a dark complexion, long hair, and was wearing a baseball cap. He couldn't see the driver because the windows were tinted. He thought the vehicle might have had a blue license plate, similar to plates he had seen on California vehicles. With so many credible witnesses independently reporting the same thing, investigators believe this was a lead worth pursuing. On August 13, 1991, they told the media they were looking for a red and white Bronco. They hoped that by releasing this information, they would receive some more tips on the hotline they had set up. They weren't disappointed. Ty Chandler and Jeff Asher contacted the task force on August 20, 1991. They were 15 and 16 years old, respectively. Ty and Jeff were interviewed separately, but their stories were nearly identical. On Friday, August 9th, Ty went over to Jeff's house, which was located 1 mile east of Wad Kunaram. They played Nintendo late into the night. At 1:45 a.m. on August 10th, they decided to head out to the field to steal some watermelons. They rode their ATVs south on Saraville Road, then turned west onto a dirt road. They stopped just east of the interstate, which was halfway between Jeff's house and the temple. Approximately 5 to 10 minutes after arriving in the fields, Jeff and Ty saw a vehicle driving north on Cotton Lane. It slowed down, shut off its headlights, and turned west onto Maryland. Ty thought the vehicle was a small or medium-sized car because the headlights were close together. After seeing the vehicle shut off its lights, Ty recalled asking Jeff what time it was. Jeff told him it was 2 a.m. Ty was concerned about the time because he had to be up at 11 a.m. and he wanted to make sure he got enough sleep. About 10 minutes later, around 2:10 a.m., Ty heard several gunshots in the distance to the west. It sounded like the shots came from a small caliber weapon. Ty asked Jeff if he heard the shots too, but Jeff hadn't heard anything. The boys assumed someone was shooting at some varmint, so they continued their search for large watermelons. 5 minutes later, there were more gunshots from the same direction. This time, both Ty and Jeff heard them loud and clear. There were 4 to 5 distinct blasts from a higher caliber weapon. Jeff thought the shots were consistent with a pump-action shotgun because there were 1-second intervals between the blasts. The boys sought higher ground and began looking to the west to see if they could tell where the shots were coming from. 10 minutes later, around 2:25 in the morning, they saw a vehicle pull out of the temple parking lot and drive east down Maryland. It looked like the same vehicle they had seen before. It turned its headlights on as it approached Cotton Lane. The vehicle made a right turn and proceeded south on Cotton Lane at a normal rate of speed. As the vehicle passed in front of the Baptist church, Ty could see the outline of the vehicle. The outside lights to the church were on, which partially illuminated the roadway. The vehicle looked like a Blazer or a Bronco. Ty thought it was two-toned in color, with a stripe down the middle, but he couldn't be sure. He concluded it was possible he was just seeing a shadow from the lights that made it look like a stripe. One detail Jeff remembered was that the taillights were rectangular in shape and were vertical to the ground. The vehicle continued down Cotton Lane until it was out of sight. The boys then returned to Jeff's house around 2:45 a.m. Can't get enough of Framed? Binge the entire season ad-free right now with a subscription to Stitcher Premium. That's right. If you subscribe to Stitcher Premium, you can hear every episode right now without waiting each week. For a free month of Stitcher Premium, go to stitcher.com/premium and use the promo code FRAMED when you select a monthly plan. That's stitcher.com/premium, promo code FRAMED. As the sprawl of the investigation expanded outward, other detectives began looking inward. Understanding the victims and what was going on in their lives is a tried and true approach to solving homicides. Detectives wanted to learn as much as they could from people in the Wad Kunaram community. This proved to be one of the biggest challenges for the task force. Not only were they dealing with language barriers, but there were significant cultural differences as well. The task force received a lot of outside help to bridge those gaps. Assistance came from officers in Los Angeles, Las Vegas, Toronto. A Thai ambassador even flew into Phoenix to meet with public officials. Experts in Southeast Asian culture prepared and distributed an internal memo to detectives with some tips to be used when conducting their interviews. Here's an example of one of those tips. Officers may have already noted how the Thais and the Laotians are always smiling, even in the midst of calamity and grief. This behavior is a result of their dislike of showing any emotions, which may disturb the peace or tranquility of others. They very seldom spill their guts or impose their problems on others. They make extraordinary efforts to remain pleasant, even in the most trying circumstances. They take great pride in maintaining still waters. Officers may feel that people in the community are afraid of them. However, they may only just be startled by our comparatively more aggressive behavior. We are generally more direct and spend less time on pleasantries. In addition, they may feel that their poor English may render them susceptible to misunderstandings. Taking this into account, officers can benefit from simply slowing down and attempting to exchange pleasantries while tuning in to their level of language ability rather than launching directly into a line of questioning. Given a chance, they will be very hospitable and forthcoming. Additional information about the victims' lives came into the task force from an unexpected source. Paul Rogers was a reporter with the Arizona Republic. He was sent to Thailand to write a story about the victims' families. He was selected for the assignment by his paper because of his knowledge of Southeast Asia. During the Vietnam War, Rogers worked as a correspondent and developed an understanding of the people and customs in the region. When Rogers returned from Thailand, he met with Russ Kimball of the task force to share what he learned on his trip. Thai police had been conducting an ongoing major investigation into corruption involving 44 Thai temples located throughout the world. Although Wad Kunaram wasn't on their list, the Los Angeles temple was under the scrutiny of the Thai police. Their investigation was finding that Buddhist temples were rife with scandals. Rogers also shared that he was considering the prospect that drugs played a role in the murders at the temple. Two of the victims, Somsak Sopa and Boonchoy Chirod, were from villages in Thailand that supplied most of the world's heroin. His research indicated heroin trafficking from that region had increased dramatically over the previous 2 years. The heroin business provided the main source of revenue for their hometowns. Given that, it seemed more likely than not that those two were involved in the heroin scene. When investigators dug a little deeper, things only looked worse. In the early 1980s, Boonchoy's father was arrested in Thailand for smuggling heroin. Another concern was that most of the members of Wad Kunaram knew very little about Somsak and Boonchoy. They had only just moved into the temple 3 weeks prior to their deaths. This news Rogers shared with authorities came as no surprise. There were investigators on the task force whose sole focus prior to the temple murders was Asian organized crime in the greater Phoenix area. Those specialists, along with members of the FBI and DEA, were already surveilling several individuals whom they suspected were heroin smugglers. According to the reports we reviewed, Wad Kunaram wasn't thought to have been involved with heroin prior to the killings. The temple murders compelled authorities to reevaluate that presumption. They began gathering information on the involvement of the monks and other Buddhist temples into the trafficking of narcotics. It didn't take long for their everyday drug surveillance work to overlap with their work on the temple case. A suspect they had been keeping tabs on for years showed up at the monks' funerals at Wad Kunaram. A confidential and reliable informant reported this individual was given special treatment, even royal treatment, while in attendance. Amongst the documents the FRAME team obtained was a 66-page legal document requesting wiretaps on suspected heroin traffickers. We're not going to get into specifics here, but we can tell you that the individuals subject to those wiretaps settled in the Phoenix area in the 1970s. At that time, they established several companies, mostly in the restaurant or food service industry. This idea that local Thai restaurants might be involved in heroin trafficking captured the attention of the task force. Remember Smith Tongkom, the temple board member who told the papers, "I think it was some rednecks"? Asian gangs probably wouldn't do this. In the wake of the murders, he became a spokesman of sorts for the Wat Khun Aram community. He was also the owner of the Spicy Thai restaurant in downtown Phoenix. When the Thai ambassador flew into the U.S. and met with the governor and other task force leaders, they met at the Spicy Thai restaurant. Putting himself in the spotlight the way he did would come back to bite Smith. The authorities started investigating him, and it turned out Smith Tongkom wasn't his real name. His real name was Lam Thong Sutishard, and he had been convicted of smuggling heroin into the U.S. in 1978. Back then, he was facing charges in a Los Angeles court. Before his trial concluded, he fled, and in doing so, he forfeited a $75,000 bond. The Los Angeles DEA office believed he returned to Thailand, when in fact he had moved to Phoenix and changed his name. Spicy Thai Smith, as he came to be known, wasn't the only individual associated with Wat Khun Aram that had a rap sheet. Detectives ran the names of all the temple members through the Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs Information System. They got four hits. There were four individuals associated with the temple who had either been suspected or were convicted of moving heroin. The temple phone records were also revealing. Just 9 days before the murders, there were phone calls placed to the Thai Teparad restaurant in Hollywood, California. The restaurant was owned by two Thai citizens. One of the owners was believed to be involved in the heroin trade. The FBI also considered him a suspect in the murder of one of their confidential informants. The authorities eventually went after him, but he evaded capture. Now, in our initial pass through the crime scene, there were a few things we purposely skipped over. These things should make more sense now that we have some context. These next few clues support this idea that certain members of the temple were involved in the drug trade. On the evening of August 14, 1991, two drug-sniffing dogs were sent into the temple. These dogs were trained to detect heroin, cocaine, and marijuana. The first dog hit on an area of the floor along the north wall of the worship area. The dog also had a positive reaction to a filing cabinet in the head monk's bedroom. When the second dog searched the building, it hit on the exact same areas as the first dog. No drugs were found in the temple, but it's likely the dogs were picking up trace residue from narcotics. After a more thorough search, they found something else in the worship area. On the west side of the room near the shrine was a trapdoor leading to a secret crawl space. Drug-sniffing dogs were sent into this crawl space, but they didn't find anything in there. Obviously, the secret space could have been used for anything, but if someone was planning to hide drugs in the temple, that would have been a great spot. The temple was flying under the authorities' radar, and even if it wasn't, what are the odds they would have ripped up floorboards so close to a religious shrine? In the temple living room, attached to the east wall, was a neatly organized tack board. It was so close to the bodies that there were actually droplets of blood splattered on the wall around the tack board. Bunched together, pinned to the board, were business cards for 9 businesses in the Phoenix area. All 9 of these businesses were in the Thai grocery or restaurant industry. Of note, the Spicy Thai restaurant was among them. Directly below the tack board was a crudely drawn map of the expressways that ran through Phoenix and Tucson. On the map, there were 9 square markings. Some of those markings correspond to the locations of the restaurants shown on the tack board. The potential significance of the tack board and the map should probably go without saying. Several Thai restaurants in the area were owned by individuals suspected of moving heroin, and right there at the scene were those business cards for 9 Thai restaurants and grocery stores. The last clue we'll cover was found on the dining room table. There was a notebook with a suspicious message. Written in Thai at the top of the paper were directions to get from Phoenix to a high school parking lot in Placentia, California. The note also instructed its recipient to use the payphone in the parking lot to dial the phone number of a nearby residence and ask for Pet. The message ended with this sentence: "It now weighs 1,083 pounds. That specific amount, 1,083 pounds, had just come up in another DEA case. A few months before the temple murders, on June 20, 1991, authorities raided a warehouse in Hayward, California. They seized approximately 1,080 pounds of pure China white heroin. The estimated street value of the heroin was between $1.3 and $3 billion. To this day, it remains the largest heroin seizure in U.S. history. The shipment came in on a boat leaving from a port in Taiwan. The heroin, however, was from Thailand. The drugs were hidden in two containers, holding 2,720 boxes. In the boxes were plastic bags that were marked as grocery produce items. When more than $1 billion of heroin gets confiscated, there's bound to be consequences for someone. The task force was strongly considering the possibility that the Temple murders were carried out as retribution for the seizure. The heroin hit theory went something like this. Monks Somsak and Bunchoy were involved with moving the heroin that was seized in California. When things went south, they fled, eventually ending up at the Temple in Arizona. When whoever had it out for Somsak and Bunchoy made their move, they decided to leave no witnesses. Somsak and Bunchoy were two of the monks that received the worst of the shotgun blasts. Maybe those shots were fired to make sure the intended targets of the hit did not survive. While the heroin hit theory seemed promising, the task force continued to work other angles. If they could only find the guns that fired those shell casings, maybe they could solve this thing. Hundreds of Marlin 22 caliber weapons were seized and tested, but as time went on, it seemed less and less likely they would find a match. 1 month into the investigation, on September 10, 1991, Detective Rick Sensabaugh walked into the task force's headquarters, held a confiscated Marlin rifle above his head, and jokingly announced, "I've got the murder weapon right here." Testing that rifle would have to wait, though. The case was already moving in another direction. Since Rick had just returned to the office, he hadn't heard the good news. A tip came in on the hotline that promised to bust this case wide open.
"This is Officer Scar. May I help you?"
"Yeah, I need to talk to somebody about... Okay, let me explain something to you real quick, okay? A while back, there was this guy who, for some reason or another, was talking about some kind of murder that happened in Phoenix at the Buddhist temple.
Huh?
You might want to talk to this guy."
"Okay, you think he might know something?"
"Well, I don't know. Just, he said he knew something. And he's got a Bronco."
"What's his name?"
"Kelsey Lawrence."
This season, Unframed.
"Whenever I blow up, my adrenaline starts pumping at twice the strength that it normally would have. You know, I can fight anybody."
"That weapon has been tested by experts. That weapon, like Larry's saying, was used to kill 9 people."
"Well, I explained that the puzzle piece that's missing, it's in your pocket. And all you have to do is reach down there and give it to us. And we'll get this thing. We'll get this thing all put together, you know? Nice, neat little package."
I would like to thank Marissa Wiru-Hiran for her help in pronouncing Thai names and words. She is a local entrepreneur in Kansas City who, in the 1980s, lived in America with her husband and children. Her husband was killed, and that prompted her to learn English and get a college education to help herself and her family. I think she's amazing. These days, she is remarried, and she owns 3 restaurants. If you aren't local to KC but want to try one of her products, go to kctastytai.com. That's kctastytai.com to learn more. Or if you're in the Kansas City area, I highly recommend going to a Tasty Thai restaurant. Music for season 2 of Framed was created by The Captain. His website is truecrimegarage.com. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Framed ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.